Since she ran away, Rosanna, yeah. Now she's gone, and I have to say,
good afternoon, and it seems only 12 hours since we were leaping around drunkenly in a stranger's house, kissing random strangers on the lips, and stealing random strangers' booze. During the next 90 minutes, the final time-wasting radio show of the series will help to establish ourselves firmly in the new year and prevent us from accidentally slipping back to somewhere around last April. My name's Rodri Marsden, and traditionally I use this introduction to advise you of all the forthcoming treats and live studio guests. But today is a public holiday, and the only treat you're likely to experience during the next 90 minutes is me. I've never been described as a treat before, and I'm unlikely to be described as such in the future. But for the time being, at least, I'm your very special treat. I'll be playing your records by Bunty Chunks, Sarandon, The Numbers Band, Swans. I'll be telling you about Dunstable and also my dad's autobiography. I normally talk over this bit, but let's just enjoy Toto for a moment.
Now she's gone, and I have to say,
in a few minutes' time, Steve Graziak will be telling us of the sporting highlights of 2005. Mine, of course, would be cheering like mad at the Oval a couple of months ago as England beat Australia in the Ashes series. In fact, I'm unlikely to experience a sporting moment quite that good ever again and should probably abandon any further interest in sport just to preserve the moment. But Steve will be here nevertheless, and so will Neil Scott, delivering his thought for the year, which he thought would be broadcast on Christmas Day because of erroneous information I gave him. Sorry about that, Neil. And also Andrew Ward's microscopic examination of the world of politics in 2005. No Prove Me Wrong this week, no live session, just a few records, and me rambling on as interestingly as I know how. More bands should consist of an Asian whiz kid metal guitarist, a drummer playing along to a metronome, a bass player who sits on a small stool, and a huge female singer giving 101%. This is not the opinion of very many A&R scouts for major record labels, sadly, but it is my opinion, and proof of my theory is now forthcoming with the very wonderful Bunty Chunks. Was Bunty Chunks from their one and only album with the song We Grow Up With Bones. I spent the Yuletide period in Dunstable, a Bedfordshire town that's roughly sellotaped onto the edge of Luton. I grew up there and my parents still live on the northwestern edge of the town. I arrived back at their house at about 2:45 p.m. on Christmas Eve to discover that in the year since I was last there, they've had a conservatory built. Yes, a conservatory. They didn't tell me because they wanted it to be a surprise. Oh dear, I said, how much did it cost? My ambivalence quickly turned to joy when I realised that I could sit in there and be out of earshot of the strains of people plunging to their certain deaths on Holby City or Casualty or whatever it's called now. It's a pretty good conservatory, as conservatories go. Apparently, it's been on the cards since my mother said I'd quite like a conservatory, and my father got out some graph paper and started to make some plans. It has underfloor heating, a minuscule Christmas tree, and an adjoining toilet. From the age of 8 until 18, I always had to go upstairs to go to the toilet. My parents have now provided me with this facility, albeit 26 years too late. I hope they're suitably ashamed. On my first evening, I went for a walk into town. I've not seen dense fog like this dense fog I saw since the last dense fog I saw in Dunstable. A real pea super with added bacon bits. I walked past the old Lancot School playing fields that have since been obliterated to make room for a swanky housing estate, while the youth of Tottenham Road quadruple in size in front of their PlayStations. I gazed up Dunstable Downs and reminisced about the Windsock, a ludicrously shaped pub which was demolished in the early 80s and sat at the foot of the Downs with a red and white Windsock on the roof. I never went in, but I'd have liked to. I walked up West Street into town, marvelling at all the businesses that, by rights, should have failed years ago but still managed to scrape by. Or maybe they thrive, I don't know. I've not seen their end-of-year accounts. The Pheasant Pub serving free curry on a Friday night. R.E. Lay Building Contractors. Cordova Old People's Home. Linden House Nursery School, where I slowly and deliberately knocked over a tray of orange squash on my first full afternoon away from my mother. West Street Wools, still providing for the knitting fraternity of southeast Bedfordshire. The Yum Yum Cafe, still serving up food as mundane as it always has. The Dunstable Model Shop, still apparently trying to sell the same model boat that it was trying to sell in 1986. Then round the corner into High Street North. F.L. Moore's, where I ordered obscure indie 12 inches, has shut down, while a bridal shop upstairs still does brisk trade. People seem more interested in wedding presents than the wedding present these days. Then the Gem Kebab House, continuing to sit there, empty, with an elephant's leg of spiced lamb slowly revolving in the moonlight. When you tell people that you're from Dunstable, they tend to laugh. It wasn't always like this, of course. At one point, it was a crucial junction between the Roman roads of Watling Street and Icknield Way, and an essential stop for wayfarers to rest. These days, people head for the Little Chef, about 5 miles north of the town, en route to Milton Keynes. Also, during the 1960s, Dunstable had a world-renowned concert venue, the California Ballroom. This was shut down in late 1977 after a spirited campaign by a local councillor who lived near the venue and couldn't stand the sound of people enjoying themselves. But in its short history, it had become an essential stopping-off point for legendary soul artists such as James Brown and punk or post-punk acts such as The Jam and The Clash. There's a tribute website to the California Ballroom, where there are numerous affectionate tributes to the venue from various people, although Billy Idol isn't amongst them. Apparently, he had a strop at the California Ballroom when the drummer of The Cure pissed on his leg. Today, Dunstable is without a concert venue of any description, and this has been the case for a long, long time. Faced with the prospect of no entertainment, young people are left with two options: either get out of Dunstable as quickly as possible, or hang around on street corners. I opted for the former, but the majority went for the latter, and today ASBOs are being handed out faster than sick bags on a turbulent aircraft. In the meantime, schools, municipal buildings, and patches of green land are being cleared to build supermarkets. So many supermarkets. So while I'm in Dunstable, I've access to limitless supplies of fresh herbs and umpteen varieties of long grain rice. But if I want to have fun, well, I'm restricted to staying in with limitless supplies of fresh herbs and umpteen varieties of long grain rice. This is Scritti Politti.
That you need, you time you take it, it gets so hard, it gets so very hard to do. Each time we break it, much greater than before. You heard all those sweet things, but you know too much to ever let it happen. You know how to listen, how to look and find there's no one worth your worry. Every time you wake up, every time I see there's something left to do, oh man. You who have nothing, much greater than before. You better think twice, I'll call you at home. There isn't something to make you go. To ever get to feeling ease, oh. Got more sickness, it gets so hard, it gets so very hard to do, oh. But you got more sickness, much greater than before. Please don't forget, oh no.
That was Skritti Politti with the song A Slow Soul from the 1980 album Songs to Remember. Green, singer of the band, drinks in my sister's local pub in Dalston, and many's the time I've wanted to collar him in the bogs and tell him how perfect his debut single Skank Block Bologna was. Then a few months ago I heard him on the radio saying how much he hated his debut single Skank Block Bologna. So, a lucky escape for me, and indeed him. For the first six time-wasting radio shows, I invited special guests onto the programme in order to play the game called Prove Me Wrong, in which they tried to persuade me that music they were particularly fond of was a lot better than my narrow-minded opinions gave it credit for. They largely succeeded because, when it comes down to it, I'm an easily swayed, credulous fool. But for this pre-recorded show, which was to go out on Christmas Day but is now reaching you on the first day of the new year, I've utterly failed to find anyone willing to take time out of their Yuletide schedules. And frankly, who can blame them? I mean, I've had trouble finding time in my own Yuletide schedule to record this. So, in the absence of the Prove Me Wrong slot this week, I'm going to attempt to prove myself right. Since I was 18, I've been in a multitude of bands, some better than others, but all singularly unsuccessful. Sometimes I wonder whether it was all a complete waste of time, financially senseless, artistically questionable, and culturally moribund. I will now, self-indulgently, spend the next 10 to 15 minutes trying to make myself feel a bit better about it all. So, listeners, I beg your forgiveness. I joined a band called the Keatons when I came to London to go to university. I was already a fan of theirs and had watched them reduce many and various London audiences to single figures with their abrasive, confrontational pop music. Steve, the bass player, saw in me an enthusiasm, a passion, but more importantly, a malleability and a pliability, which would enable him to achieve his goal of playing more gigs per year than any other indie band in London. So I started to play guitar for them at the end of 1989 and neglected my studies to spend the prime years of my life in the company of men nearly 10 years older than me. They'd have a profound effect on my emotional development. Over the next 6 years, there were a fantastic range of appalling and largely avoidable experiences. The other guitarist, Dave, had a nervous breakdown on stage at North London Polytechnic, falling to his knees in floods of tears, clutching a wallet in one hand and a watch in the other, and thrusting them alternately towards the crowd in time to the music, while we carried on in the mistaken belief that he was merely very drunk. He was later picked up by the police on Brixton Hill at 2 a.m, trying to give money to strangers. In 1991, we broke down on the Paris Ring Road in rush hour in the height of summer and tried to placate the police with the offer of one of our critically panned 12-inch EPs. We spent days upon days driving across Eastern Europe, playing games like There It Is, where you decide on an object, say a haystack, and the first person to see one and say There It Is wins the game. The hours crawled by. We stayed in a squat in Switzerland where none of the toilets had doors, and we carried around a large piece of cardboard to place across the door whenever we went, much to the amusement and derision of the Swiss. We played gigs in a variety of terrible lineups, purely to stick to the unwritten rule of never ever blowing out a gig. I was forced to play drums once in Chesham, which was a particularly horrendous example of this. And of course there were a succession of low-selling records, which John Peel was kind enough to play, but hey, we were kind enough to send them to him. We played our last gig in May 2005 at an outdoor festival in Jena, Germany. I had a feeling it would be the last one, and tipped a bottle of German beer over my head in celebration just before we launched into the last song. That song was called Toys. We'll be right back. That was one of my former bands, the Ketons, with the song Toys, B-side to 7-inch single Recidivist Dish from 1989 on the wonderfully named Chewy Records. While my guitaring and eating skills were being exercised to the max in the Ketons, I met three men from the Bedford area who were looking for a singer for their band, which they decided to call Flat Stanley. I didn't think that Flat Stanley was a very good name. In the end, they called it Gag, which I didn't think was a very good name either, but it stuck and I joined. Leighton, the drummer, who now drums with the very wonderful Country Teasers and the equally marvellous Montana Pete, wrote all the songs and gave me the poorly spelt lyrics on dog-eared bits of paper scrawled in illegible biro. Kevin, the guitarist, became a close friend, and I rewarded him by recruiting him to the Ketons to sing, dragging him into an impoverished life of hell, which he's never really managed to quite break out of since. For which I apologise most sincerely. Anyway, Gag, the basic premise was guitars, shouting, and as little rehearsal as we could possibly get away with. The songs quickly became more and more oblique as we went to see bands like the Dogfaced Hermans, the Stretchheads, Dawson and the X, who were all playing around London during 1991 and 1992. On my 21st birthday, we went into the studio and recorded our debut 7-inch EP and were astounded when John Peel offered us a session. We recorded seven songs at Maida Vale, during which Mitty Adhikari, the engineer, said of one of them, "Yeah, that one's quite good. It sounds a bit like Queen." What bigger compliment can you get? During a gig in Camden, I accidentally kicked the bass player in the groin, which signalled the beginning of a difficult period of time for the band, as Leighton the drummer was convinced that I'd done it on purpose. I would hereby like to set the record straight and say that it certainly was not on purpose, and I'm sorry for my clumsiness. A couple of years later, however, all was forgotten, and we managed to get an Arts Council-funded trip to play at the Sziget Festival in Budapest, during which our spirited and lively performance was the hit of the week, and after which we went to play a much smaller gig in nearby Szentendre, supporting Blurt. We were so drunk, we couldn't stand up, and ended the evening arguing with members of Blurt over dinner and throwing food about. At the time, it was fun. In retrospect, highly embarrassing. We returned to the UK and celebrated by recording an album and then doing very little else. In theory, we're still going, but we haven't rehearsed since 2001, so don't hold your breath. Oh, you weren't going to. Fine. Where is the brown party now? Was Gag with me singing from the 1999 album When People Start Slapping Meat on Marble. What with all that caterwauling, shouting and prancing about, I needed to make some music that was a bit more, well, boring. By this stage, I developed obsessions with Prefab Sprout and Steely Dan, the latter to such an extent that I was going out of my way to attend gigs by Steely Dan tribute bands. If you decide to do the same thing, by the way, may I recommend heartily Stoke-on-Trent's Nearly Dan, who are a good time act with bags of joie de vivre, and suggest that you avoid London's Stealing Dan, who are a bad-tempered bunch of inadequate musos with only a passing interest in the material they're playing. Anyway, as I say, I thought it was about time I wrote some pop songs, and so I started a band called The Free French. I'd assembled a bit of recording gear at home, and I started to explore how it all worked, spending a lot of time in the back room debugging MIDI signal paths, and occasionally even playing an instrument. Shortly after this, and maybe as a direct consequence, who knows, I split up with my then wife, which suddenly, and in a rather cliched manner, it has to be said, made it very easy for me to write lyrics. So, I recorded an album in about 6 weeks, and when I played it to my mates, rather than get tight-lipped responses or rapid changing of the subject, they actually reassured me that it was quite good. And it didn't seem like they were doing so out of pity, either. I quickly assembled a band with my sister on keyboards and other friends filling in the other slots. And we went about playing gigs, at first to packed houses, and then rapidly dwindling crowds as one's friends lose interest in seeing you play the same set of 11 songs for the umpteenth time. By this time last year, enormous numbers of personnel had come and gone, and we finally settled on a lineup which featured two keyboard players and a guitarist who had studied the electric guitar at some college in Boston, Massachusetts, and was able to play any Toto guitar solo on demand. Quite an asset, I'm sure you'll agree. We recorded an album, which came out last April, called A Place of Our Own, and it received unanimous slagging in the few reviews it got on the internet. We're all still rather puzzled by this, as we truly believe that it's quite good. Now it's your chance to judge for yourself, as I play for you the Hall & Oates-inspired closing track on the album, the lovely, the beautiful, the exquisite, I wrote this song, by the way, the magnificent Holiday at Home.
Signs, you might be getting sick of me.
There you heard me with my band The Free French and the song Holiday at Home. And I'd like to thank myself there for filling in the previous 15 minutes in the absence of a guest on this week's show. I hope that what it lacked in free-form banter, it made up for in sheer musical quality. Somebody else who exudes sheer quality is Steve Graziak, who for the last 7 or 8 weeks has been keeping us informed on events in the world of sport. What better thing to do on January the 1st, 2006, than to ask Steve for his incisive and informed views on the previous year from a sporting perspective. Steve, take it away.
Football in 2005 was dominated by the rise to prominence of Chelsea, who through the latter half of the dullest Premiership season in memory combined the ruthless defensive efficiency of George Graham's Arsenal with the attacking skills of Babe Bassett's Wimbledon, really. American business tycoon Malcolm Glazer completed his takeover of Manchester United, a move which led to death threats, burning of the American flag and profane and violent demonstrations outside Old Trafford. Goodness knows what they would have done if they'd persuaded Eric Jemba Jemba to stay. Liverpool completed the second greatest comeback in European Cup final history to defeat Milan on penalties in Istanbul. Rumours that all the winners' medals were given to Steven Gerrard have yet to be confirmed. And England were given a World Cup final draw so easy that maybe Emil Heskey's recall wouldn't be such a risk after all. The undoubted highlight of the cricketing year came at the Oval in September, when we realised that Channel 4's cricket coverage had come to an end and that we might never have to hear Mark Nicholas ever again. England fast forward Darren Goff, though, became an unlikely national celebrity after he won the BBC's Strictly Come Dancing competition. England's batsmen were accused of lacking convincing footwork during their recent defeat to Pakistan, and I'm not sure Andrew Strauss using the foxtrot to try and smother a Shane Warne leg break is going to work. And we won the Ashes as well. In rugby union, Wales completed the Grand Slam as England continued their post-World Cup decline. When the team boss decides that wanting to become a manager of a rubbish team in a completely different sport is a good idea, then you know you're in trouble. But before that, Sir Clive Woodward oversaw the British Lions during a 3-0 series humiliation against the All Blacks on a tour that saw Gavin Henderson duped into a staged photo with Woodward to show that he was not annoyed at being left out of the first test lineup. Henderson was left orange with anger. Roger Federer went from strength to strength to strength to strength in tennis, scooping 2 more Grand Slam titles, whilst graciously letting Marat Safin and Rafael Nadal have the Australian and French Opens between them. Federer has now won so many trophies that perhaps he should get a sponsorship deal with Brasso. But Federer, who is perhaps the world's nicest sportsman, also prevented Scottish youngster Andy Murray from landing his first professional title by defeating him in the final of the Thailand Open. Great things await Murray in 2006, with him almost certain to snag the British number one spot from Tim Henman and also get his picture on bottles of Robinson's Special R in June. The year in boxing saw a largely successful year for British and Irish boxers. Unknown Irish fighter Kevin McBride humiliated former world heavyweight champion Mike Tyson in July in a bout that could well have been Tyson's last, until his management can persuade someone with no arms to get in the ring so that Tyson might be able to beat them. 2005 also saw a number of bizarre incidents in the world of snooker, no more so than Jimmy White's decision to change his name temporarily to James Brown as part of a sponsorship deal with HP Source. 4 years meant, though, that he was less the godfather of snooker and more that bloke with the dodgy hairdo that used to edit Loaded magazine. Former world champion Peter Ebdon caused controversy during his world championship quarter final against Ronnie O'Sullivan by playing deliberately slowly. Some watchers didn't seem to notice, though. Cliff Thorburn was heard to comment, "Blimey, that Tony Drago sure went bald." Elsewhere in sport, London won the race to host the 2012 Olympic Games, fighting off a strong challenge from Paris. Allegations came to light recently, though, that London only won the contest because an IOC member pushed the wrong button. Cautionary tale there to anyone who listens to the Sugar Babes on their iPod. In athletics, Paula Radcliffe continued to erase memories of the disastrous 2004 Olympics by winning the London and Helsinki marathons, the former of which was achieved despite an unscheduled toilet break. That must have really annoyed her. I mean, it's bad enough when that happens in a long queue at the post office, but after you've just run 18 and a half miles, forget about it. And finally, in what I'm sure was your sporting heart of the year, by the way, Roderick, Bill the Power Taylor won his 12th World Darts title by beating Mark Flash Studbridge 7-4 in the final. Taylor is now odds on with bookmakers to win his 13th World title, and he's already through to the third round of the ongoing World Championship. But the best thing about darts, and I know that many people dismiss darts and say it's not a proper sport or anything, but the best thing about darts are the nicknames.
You're going to have to remind me of these, Steve, because I don't feel that I'm quite up to speed. So remind me.
Well, since I was a kid, and for some reason when I was a kid, I just used to like darts. I have absolutely no idea why. It seems to have become law. Every darts player going has to have a ridiculous nickname. So you've got Phil the Power Taylor and you've got Mark Flash Studbridge. You've also got players like Bob Anderson. He's called the Rhinestone Cowboy.
Right.
The reason he's called the Rhinestone Cowboy is because he wears outfits that have got a bit of trim on them. So apparently that makes him like a country and western singer. You've also got, I think there's a player called Wayne Mardle. I might be getting them mixed up, but I'm, you know.
It doesn't really matter. No, I mean, no one's going to write in and complain. It's, but
no, I wouldn't imagine
we just want to hear. We just want to hear stupid names.
Well, he's called he's called Hawaii 501.
Right. Because he wears a hula skirt, or what is it?
Well, looking at your average darts player, I'm hoping not.
No.
They tend to be rather portly chaps.
He eats lots of pineapple and ham on pizza.
I'm not, well, I mean, you know, the darts player's diet, and maybe this is a bit of a stereotypical view, so I do apologise to any darts players that might be listening. I know that many of them tune into Resonance FM. The average darts player's diet appears to consist of beer.
Well, it would be a boring world indeed if all the darts players' nicknames were just the beer drinker. Fred the beer drinker Thomas. It would get dull after a while. Steve, many thanks for your sporting expertise over the past few weeks, and I hope it hasn't distracted you from more pressing issues that you should have been dealing with. This is Stitched Backfoot Airman. It's too difficult. that was Stitched Back Foot Airman from the mini LP Seven Egg Timing Greats from something like 1986 or so. Now it's time to turn to my intellectual guru, Neil Scott, who has spent this radio series giving us some appetizing food for thought every week. But now it's time for him to sum up the last 12 months in a 75-second soundbite in Neil Scott's Thought for the Year.
Last night I bought a loaf of bread. This morning I ate two slices of toast. 2 hours later, a faint queasiness taught me that A, the bread was slightly off, and B, contrary to what I'd supposed, small matters irritate me far more than world events. I had wanted to talk about all that was newsworthy in 2005. The race riots, world poverty, violent weather, Iraq, terrorism, and other such illustrations of the human condition. My intention had been to talk about how these things impose themselves on daily life, about how Live 8 and the Pope's funeral attempted to make instant history. But all this pales in comparison to my mouldy bread. The trouble is that by searching for historical meaning, we relegate everyday life to the margins. Yet everyday life is where we live. And so, as this is Christmas Day, I urge you to stop worrying about those abstract people less fortunate than yourselves, and think instead about the people around you.
For a pleasant Sunday afternoon, why don't you tune to Time Wasting with Rodri Marsden on Resonance
was Neil Scott's Thought for the Year, and you can read more extended musings of his on the Minds Construction website at www.tmcq.co.uk. But now on the Time Wasting Radio Show, it's time for some freeform Japanese magma-inspired bass and drum explosions. So here they are, that most Christmassy of bands, it's Ruins.
Yeah.
As most of you will know, the magic of Christmas tends to wear off throughout your 20s. By the time you're 34, you find it difficult to think of anything you might want for Christmas. At least anything you might want that someone can actually afford to get you. My father neatly sidestepped this problem on Christmas morning by giving me a CDR which contained a 40-page Word document entitled My Autobiography. Not many people will have received their dad's autobiography for Christmas. Except perhaps the long-suffering children of B-list celebrities who got a remaindered copy of their dad's ghost-written, low-selling tome as a pathetic stocking filler. But this was an illuminating read, piecing together bits of information I vaguely knew and other bits that I didn't into a coherent timeline of events. One thing I didn't know was that the subject he studied at college was called heavy craft, incorporating woodwork, metalwork and so on. He went on to become a teacher, but these days, of course, the subjects of woodwork and metalwork have long since evaporated. On page 32, he says, "The whole discipline of craftsmanship is rapidly disappearing. Even teachers now going into schools to teach technology have no appreciation of tools, machinery and materials. Is it any wonder this country has lost 1 million manufacturing jobs in the last 10 years? Very soon, most, if not all, craft skills will be lost, since there will be no one left to teach them." My father would probably not be encouraged by the Create and Craft Hour, which is a programme on the Ideal World Shopping Channel, which aims to open to us a whole new world, a whole new world of craft. Ideal World's concept of craft is, as you might expect, somewhat different to my father's. No hints on using bandsaws or creating modest items of household furniture or decorative fruit bowls. No, the craft of today is essentially about sticking bits of paper together with glue. The Create and Craft Hour contains styles of paper and glue that are suitable for all the family and provide limitless paper and glue combinations, whetting the appetites of a new generation of craftsmen and craftswomen. "Look at this stencil," says the hyperactive TV presenter. "Just imagine how useful this stencil is going to be." She holds up a pink piece of plastic with various flower-shaped holes cut into it. A stencil on which the hopes of Britain's manufacturing industry ultimately rest. 821-311 is your item number for this fantastic stencil, so call us on 0800 500 600 or go tippy-tappy time on your computer to www.createandcraft.tv. You don't receive many invitations these days to go tippy-tappy time on your computer, but somehow I managed to resist the temptation, glued as I was to a screen bursting with fluorescent, sparkle-bright self-adhesive and fairy crystal glitter paint. These products enable you to write magic messages of love to your nearest and dearest that might elicit a "that's nice" before being placed on the mantelpiece for a couple of days at most. Today's craft, you see, just isn't built to last. You've never seen as many beautiful stickers as you have on Create and Craft Hour, and the presenter tells us that she has 101 uses for these stickers, which presumably begin with sticking the sticker onto things and end God knows where. The Celebrate sticker set features 47 stickers bearing words like wish, party, happy, and togetherness. Whereas the Friends and Love set is awesome to behold, featuring phrases such as sending you love, just for you, and I love you so much. What could possibly say I love you so much better than a glittery sticker with the words I love you so much pre-embossed on it? I'm hard pushed to think of anything. Butterfly sticker set is accompanied by the words explore, happiness and dreams, while the flower set says to us things like cherish, forever and eternal. Sadly, the sticker set, which features the words bollard, manure and pardon and bears images of soulless office blocks, must have sold out long ago. The capacity for creativity afforded by these products maybe isn't quite as enormous as Create and Craft Hour would like to think. As the hour draws to a close, we're taught the 12 core techniques of making greetings cards and shown a book which tells us that anyone can do craft. All you need, it seems, is some of Erica's patchwork paper and a Tiny Tints mini ink set and paper toppings kit. Tearing is the new cutting, says the presenter, tearing a piece of paper into magnificently irregular shapes. Meanwhile, my father wanders out of the living room in disgust and goes out to the shed to switch on his lathe. Where will the next generation of craftsmen come from? He asks plaintively in his autobiography. I don't have an answer for him. I certainly feel adequately prepared to colour in neatly using felt-tip pens. But if I ever want a set of specially made, nesting occasional tables, I think I'll be asking my dad for a great deal of assistance. This is William D. Drake. And that was William D. Drake, former keyboard player with the Cardiacs, with the song Large Life. And now it's time to turn to a man who doesn't know about playing keyboards, but man, does he know about what's going on at Westminster. Here's Andrew Ward with a complete rundown of everything that happened in 2005 in the world of politics.
Hello, Rodri, and it's been another roller coaster of the year. Although not a particularly scary one. Certainly nothing along the lines of the nemesis at Alton Towers, for example. It's been a log flume of a year. We've seen the ban on fox hunting finally come into force, new legislation enabling same-sex partnerships, the relaxation of licensing laws, and the election of a new Tory leader called David. 2005 also saw the political demise of David Blunkett for the second time, and the actual demise of much-loved former Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Modem. Fiery, feisty, flame-haired, firebrand former Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, and grumpy yachtsman Edward Heath. But Tony Blair will remember 2005 as the year when he won a historic third term in government. The general election campaign was fought against the backdrop of the war in Iraq and the bitterest campaign within Bethnal Green and Bow, where Blairite loyalist Una King was defeated by George Galloway amid accusations of intimidation, racism and vote rigging. Since the election, Ms King has continued to work for her former constituents, while Mr Galloway has also been tireless on their behalf, travelling to Damascus to praise Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, supporting Iran's right to nuclear weapons, and claiming that the media are controlled by Zionists, who he blamed for creating the conditions that caused Jews to escape from Europe in the 1930s. Mr Galloway is frequently described as left-wing and anti-war, but one politician who actually is left-wing and anti-war is London Mayor Ken Livingstone, who came under fire for likening an Evening Standard reporter to a Nazi concentration camp guard. Mr Livingstone accused Oliver Feingold of working for a paper that had a record of supporting fascism and said that the Evening Standard was a load of scumbags and reactionary bigots. Former Evening Standard restaurant critic Mr Livingstone was also criticised for scrapping the Routemaster bus 4 years after saying that only a ghastly dehumanised moron would do so. Ghastly dehumanised moron Mr Livingstone defended his decision, saying that when the Routemaster was designed, women shopped locally and disabled people didn't leave the home. He also vowed to carry on boozing, telling Time Out, "If I'm going to have a drink, I'm going to have a drink. If I ever develop a drink problem, I'm sure you'll all report it at great length and end up having a new mayor." Mr Livingstone may have an unlikely but seasonal ally in Jesus Christ, according to American Idol winner Kelly Clarkson, who told Blender magazine, "Jesus drank, it came straight from the Bible that he had a glass of wine. Actually, I don't know if it says that he really drank it, but whatever." Finally, the year ended on a mixed note for the children of former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and her husband Dennis Thatcher, Gin Snatcher. While son Mark was refused permission to continue living in Monaco, daughter Carol Thatcher was crowned Queen of the Jungle after capturing the nation's hearts by eating kangaroo testicles and urinating on live television. Rodri, have you captured the nation's hearts?
Oh, I thought you were going to carry on and saying by eating kangaroo's testicles.
It implies.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay, well, now you've made me look ridiculous. It sounded as if you were chewing on some kind of kangaroo's testicle throughout your little speech there. What are you eating?
Well, I've just been eating some species of nut, and I don't know if you can tell, but it was actually a macadamia nut. Could you tell from the sound?
Vaguely, yeah. Slightly chewy, but...
It sounded a bit like a cashew, so that could have confused you.
Well, they're similar. I mean, you know, a bit of resistance within the nut, but ultimately kind of yielding up to your teeth.
Only an idiot would have thought it was a Brazil. What did you think it was?
I thought it was a macadamia nut, but mainly because you told me earlier on. I saw Una King in a Thai restaurant earlier this year, and I apologised to her on behalf of everyone in her constituency for voting wrongly. Do you think that was the right thing? After I'd done it, I felt that I didn't know whether I'd been in full possession of the facts and whether I should have in fact said that to her or not.
No, I think that's fair enough, if I'm allowed to say so. What was she eating, by the way?
I don't know, some kind of Thai curry. Some kind of Thai curry. Possibly, I think it was duck. I think it was red duck curry. And I think she had some pad Thai and some nice steamed rice.
Because there's red curry and green curry. But there's red wine and white wine. And I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes from.
You've never had a white curry before. And you can have green wine. Of course, ginger wine is green.
It's greenish. It comes in a green bottle, so maybe that's what's confusing. It's actually more brown in colour.
What bottle does curry come in? What colour bottle?
It doesn't come in a bottle. It doesn't come in a bottle. It comes in a kind of foil tray.
Andrew, what do you have any predictions for 2006? Political predictions or indeed personal predictions? I mean, as to what might happen to yourself?
There could well be a Liberal Democrat leadership election, and I might be able to use the phrase Lib Dem leadership hopeful Ming Campbell. So that could be very exciting.
That would be fantastic. Do you think Tony Blair will win a fourth term in office next year?
I think it's odds on.
What does odds on mean? Is that good or bad?
That means it's very likely.
Very likely, okay. Andrew, thank you for turning the world of politics into something entertaining and fascinating over the past few weeks, even if it has been hats or booze that has provided the gags. Why don't they get you on the telly? When are we going to see you on the TV? That's surely the next step now.
I think it's the logical step, isn't it? For BBC to take away that picture of me in Broadcasting House and the sign saying, do not let this man in under any account.
Thank you for all of that, Andrew. You've got to go now and watch TV.
Yes, I'm going to continue watching Seinfeld. Night-night.
Bye-bye. the blistering noise of swans from the album Cop, and that was Half Life. I remember reading a review of Swans playing at the ICA in 1987 or so, and learning from that review that the band was so loud that people were throwing up at the sides of the venue. May I recommend to those people, albeit 18 years too late, an excellent pair of earplugs for about 15 quid that they sell at the Drum Cellar on Denmark Street, just opposite the Resonance FM studio. Then watch your gig-going, vomiting experiences just melt away. If this show is about anything at all, and I'm not entirely sure that it is, it's about contrasts. I desperately searched for a festive piece of music to play, something that showed a bit of initiative on my part that maybe other Resonance FM DJs probably wouldn't have played already. The best I could do was this, a Christmassy reminiscence of 1968 from the man they once referred to as Stephen Tintin Duffy.
That kind of game. Hey, hey, family. hey, family coach, my family coach. You gotta make the most of your family coach.
We've got it, sir, we've got it. To follow 8 and 9 in lunar orbit.
That was the Lilac Time from the album Looking for a Day in the Night. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is from Sarandon, friends of mine who achieved their lifetime's dream by recording a Peel session last week, only a year or so after the great man actually died. From their mini 7-inch album, The Feminist Third, this is Sarandon with Prove It.
He left the car and took the moped. He made sure he put his helmet on. He did it because he is the stupid. I was wrestled to the ground and told I ought to keep my mouth shut. I can prove it. I was wrestled to the ground and had the wind knocked out my sails.
Sarandon there, a three-piece that do not mess around. I don't know how many people have wished you a Happy New Year as yet. In my experience, it tends to get a bit wearing around about this time of the day, just after lunch, when the words Happy New Year start to sound a bit hollow, when you realise that you're well into the next year already and it's downhill from here on in, or at least until March, when the clocks go back, or forward, or whatever makes it lighter in the evenings. Despite this, I would like to wish you all a Happy New Year before the end of the show. And a cursory trawl through my collection of MP3s turned up this track by Broadcast called Long Was the Year. 2005 wasn't that much longer than any other year. In fact, if anything, it felt a bit shorter. And in proportion to my life elapsed so far, it was a bit shorter. But that's unlikely to stop me playing the record, because I think it's quite good. From the album Noise Made by People, this is Broadcast.
Sun never comes.
So here I am doing the final summing up on the final time-wasting radio show, a series which began on November the 13th as a tiny seed of hope and possibility, and pretty much remained a tiny seed of hope and possibility. If you were listening back on November the 13th, you'd have already heard that gag, and if you were already thinking that very thing, well, congratulations, you have earned 15 points, points which can be redeemed in your current Resonance FM catalogue, which should have hit your doorsteps just before Christmas. It seems proper and correct at this juncture to thank everyone who made this show's possible, regular guests Neil Scott, Andrew Ward and Steve Graziak. Live performers Keith John Adams, the playwrights Ben Wallers, aka The Rebel, Simon Bookish, Stars in Battle Dress and Rogan Whitenails. And also to all my Prove Me Wrong guests, Alex Mayer, Tommy Shotton, Paul Carney, Shirley Lee, Kev Hopper and Tim Steiner. Lastly, warmest thanks to Jamie Paul, who engineered all the shows except this one, and Ed Baxter for asking me to do it in the first place. It has been what you might call a hoot. What better way to end the series with a song from the record that kicked it off? From the album Jimmy Bell's Still in Town by The Numbers Band, surely one of the best albums ever made, this is the blisteringly wonderful song About Leaving Day. This is my leaving day. My name's Rodri Marsden, and it's been a pleasure. Happy New Year, and goodbye.
Can I get to you? and start crying because I will leave you. What did you do to make me stay in pain, in a blind confusion? I fell to the floor shaking then. It gets hard, it gets hard, it gets hard, it gets hard. Some people been telling you it's easy. It gets hard to feel. It gets hard to feel. If it gets hard to feel, then it's hard to love. Then it's hard to love. People been telling you it's easy. Some people been telling you it's easy. Some people been telling you it's easy. So I'll tell you it's hard. So I'll tell you it's hard. Looking for a change. One thing must change.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good evening.